Cranial Cream Puffs, welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 22, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your four fresh fact-finding folios and floozies.
Hey.
Speak for yourself,
you're slandering
friend.
Some people here.
First we're Cranial Cream Puffs.
No, those are our listeners. I'd rather be a cream puff.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
First, we just want to start off the show with a little bit of follow-up on something we mentioned in episode 20. Longtime listeners of the show will know that we have a segment where sometimes we will have a computerized voice, robot voice, and intentionally 80s, 90s era computerized robot voice sing opening lines to popular songs.
And yeah, sing, I guess, is one way to describe it.
Yes, sing in a very monotone robot voice.
And we wanted you guys to name him.
Because, he doesn't have a name. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we have to go through the whole spiel that I just went through, which is not very poetic.
And so, since he's an 80s robot, we wanted something that was an acronym.
Yeah.
We thought about, maybe if the acronym was like Brain or possibly Brian.
Right, right. Yeah. And there are always those forced, awkward acronyms.
Like,
like
Knight Rider, right? Kit.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. The Knight Industries 2000.
Yes.
With a separate T for each one. We got a lot of good suggestions that we narrowed down.
Yeah,
and
thank
then
you guys.
Thank you to thank everyone you. Who sent something in. Ultimately, the one that just stood out to us the best was not a Brian or a Brain. It is ELVIS, which stands for Electronic Lyric Vocalization Interface System, which is so perfectly overwrought. So
I think it's fantastic. I mean, I think it just goes really well. It sounds like something real,
Yeah, and it personalizes it. You can imagine, we're the team of teenage crime fighters. Hey, Elvis, we need help with. So a big thank you to Leland Jory, who sent that in.
Yay.
Leland, well done.
Elvis.
Does Elvis have anything to say about
and
this?
And Elvis absolutely has something to say about it. So, Elvis loves first lines of songs. So Elvis really feels... Elvis and I were chatting backstage. He felt the opening line from this particular ditty really summed it up the best.
Oh, victory speech.
It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face. You were content to let me shine. That's your way.
Elvis.
Elvis.
If you have not been able to identify, that is the opening stanza from Wind Beneath My Wings.
Yes. By Bette Midler.
By Bette Midler. Yes.
Oh, thanks, Elvis.
A heartfelt rendition. We'll be hearing more from Elvis in a future episode, I'm sure.
Well, let's do this. Let's jump into our general trivia segment. Pop quiz, hotshot. And we have exciting news, and we're all very excited. We're like on the edge of our seats. We've been doing this show for more than 20 episodes now, and you may recall that I'm always complaining about the Trivial Pursuit cards that I randomly, select for this segment. And so we're going to switch things up. Recently, all four of us went to an old-timey soda fountain for lunch or brunch. And they sold these packs of vintage collectible cards, kind of like Garbage Pail cards.
Yeah,
and
the cards with the gum and the little wax paper package.
Yep.
And they have trivia battle game cards.
By Topps.
It's in wax paper. It's right here in front of me, sealed. And it's from 1984.
Yep,
nice.
Mm-hmm. So it's advertised to have over 1,500 questions in series one. In each pack, there are 9 cards, 1 sticker, and 1 stick of bubble gum.
If my math is right,
that means this piece of gum is 28 years old.
Yep.
Yes.
Chris said he was going to eat it, by the way.
I said I was going to eat it, but then I thought maybe just the loser should eat the gum.
I think the loser. Same as we're agreeing. The loser has to eat the gum.
I do not agree to these terms. Unless I win, and then it's fine.
Okay. Colin and I, whoever does worse.
I'm in, win or lose, I'm in to sample the gum.
Totally, yeah.
So this is sealed. I'm going to open it right now. Hope you can hear the
While Karen opens this, one of the things that really tickles us is not only do we have to try and answer these questions, but we have to remember this is from a 1984 mindset.
Yeah.
So anything about politics or movie hits or things like that, we have to pretend.
All right. Well, there is our piece of gum.
Right.
It's stuck to a card.
It hasn't dissolved.
Pick a trivial battle card.
So what do they look like here? Oh, they have a whole bunch of questions on
it. Yeah. It's like a mini Trivial Pursuit card.
You really get your money's worth.
Oh.
It's just attached.
You know what? It comes with rewards,
It comes with two stickers for Trivia Champ and Trivia Chump.
All right. That's better for the winner. Pick a sticker.
All right. I'm just going to pick a random one.
Okay. All right.
Here we go. I guess they have categories. The red is, I guess, silver screen. Here we go. Oh, it's people. Who played Conan's girlfriend in the first movie? What is this referring? Like Conan the Barbarian?
It must be Conan the Barbarian. Well, was that Grace Jones?
Sandahl Bergman.
Oh.
Or Grace Slick. Who? Wait, what?
Sandahl Bergman.
All right.
Oh.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
All right, next question.
Books. What is Supergirl's name on Earth?
Oh.
These are pretty
These are questions that people in the 1980s would know.
I'm going to guess. Is it like Aurora or something?
Incorrect.
No. Well, She-Ra's name is Princess Adora, which meant...
It is...
What is it?
Linda Lee.
Lee. Did not know that. Okay.
Again, with the alliterative names for a comic book character. Linda Clark Lee. Kent.
Yeah. But,
right. All right, Blue, TV film. Who starred in the motion picture Funny Girl? Dana.
Barbara Streisand?
Correct. Oh, so the orange one is High IQ. Mm. Who was the first pilot to fly faster than the speed of sound? Jeez!
It's Colin, go for it.
I believe that was Chuck Yeager.
I believe so, too.
Correct. Okay. Captain Charles Yeager.
We call him Chuck now.
Yeah.
All right. Indigo? Purple? For music. What rock performer had hits with Jeopardy and the breakup song?
I mean, I know the Weird Al did the parody. Yeah, right. I lost on Jeopardy, but I forget the name.
Our Loves in Jeopardy. I cannot retrieve that.
No.
It is Greg Kinn.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, I didn't know he had a second song. I'll admit it. Yeah.
Green for sports, Colin. It's yours. Who was the first black player in the American League?
August Jackie Robinson.
Incorrect.
Hmm.
Larry Doby.
Oh, okay. I've definitely heard Larry Doby. Huh. I don't think I would have been able to retrieve
that. These are tough. Let's do another one.
You want to do one more?
Let's do one more.
Okay.
All right. Red for people. Who directed An American Werewolf in London? Colin.
I think it was John Landis?
Yes. John Landis. Good job. Yellow for books. Who is the father of the Hardy Boys?
Mr. Hardy.
That was my guess.
No,
more specific. It is
Horatio.
Fenton Hardy, who is a detective.
Oh, okay.
Fenton
Hardy.
Not Horatio Magellan Crunch.
Horatio Magellan Crunch. Blue for TV film. Who starred as Joe Hardy in the Hardy Boys mystery? Sean Cassidy.
Sean Cassidy.
Cool. Okay, I can see that.
Okay, this one is High IQ, guys.
Uh-oh.
Who was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic?
Amelia Earhart?
Yes.
No. Why is that IQ?
I don't know.
Maybe it's High IQ given the age range it's targeted.
Right, sure.
It's for boys.
It's not specifically.
All right, Indigo for music. What city was Marvin Gaye born in?
I'll guess Detroit.
Incorrect.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Mm. Indianapolis.
Washington, D.C.
Huh.
All right, sports. Green for sports. What pitcher holds the record for most strikeouts in a single World Series game?
1984.
Most strikeouts in a single game. I mean, Cy Young holds records for so many things. I'm going to guess Cy Young.
It is Bob Gibson.
Okay. All right.
I don't know if I can prove that is right or wrong.
So this is so
That was accurate
weird.
As of 1984, at least.
Like, the 1980s, to me, it's like I grew up in, you know, half of my growing up was in the 1980s, right? And so, like, I don't think of it as being that long or that far away or that removed.
Yeah.
But to listen to these questions, which children of the 1980s would have had moderate to medium difficulty answering, and just them being just so far apart from my knowledge base right now.
Right,
it's just crazy.
Right. And then to throw on another 30 years of knowledge on top of that,
what you would have
to be required to remember. All right, trivia battle.
Trivia battle.
Trivia battle 84.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, now having lost, I will eat the gum of shame.
All right. It was meant to be.
Kyle, are we going to split this?
I want to try some.
All right, Karen, break it in half.
Guys, this gum is 28 years old.
At least. Okay. It could have been made before that.
Your point being?
Hey, Chris and I signed the waiver for a reason.
Yep. All right. I'm not going to eat it. I'm just going to, you know, chew it for a little while.
It's going to dissolve in your mouth.
All right.
Here we go.
That's my guess.
The live show.
Well, this is our last episode of Good Job, Brain.
Wow. It's dissolving in my mouth.
I told you it was going to dissolve.
Wow, it kind of just turned into a paste in my mouth.
It's like, it's falling apart and crumbling.
Yeah.
You guys are going to die. That gum is older than most of our listeners.
It's poisonous is what happens.
You know, I will give it that the flavor actually was like what I remembered, but it turned to like wallpaper paste as soon as the moisture hit it.
That was very exciting. Let's see how you guys feel in half an hour. Let us know. All right, and let's jump into our topic of the week. What a big topic. We're going to be talking about board games.
Mm-hmm. Our topic is, what's that gross taste in my mouth?
So there are so many awesome board games out there today. Very creative, original ones. There's Arkham Horror, there's Settlers of Catan, Ticket to Ride. Someone even mentioned on Facebook Kosher Land, which is the Jewish version of Candyland. Lots of versions. The range is so huge. Mm-hmm. So today we'll be talking about the origins and perhaps even the scandalous, I guess, histories behind classic board games that many of us grew up with.
Well, to kick off our discussion of board games, I have a little, you know, loosening up kind of board game quiz to get us in the mood, and I've titled it Bored Already. Over their many decades of being in existence, some of our more popular board games have undergone changes to those board games. Mm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you the alteration, and you are going to tell me the board game.
Oh, okay. I like
that. Changed the name of Dr. Black to something else. Karen?
Clue.
Yes. Clue, which is called Cluedo in the UK. The dead guy is Dr. Black. In America, it is Mr. Body. And Clue, of course, was actually originally published in the UK, and they changed it to Mr. Body when they brought it over here.
Huh.
Added a penalty for an unsuccessful challenge. Dana.
Scrabble.
Yes. Scrabble, originally published in 1948, there was no written in the rules penalty for challenging someone and getting it wrong, and that was added in 1976.
So you could just game it by challenging every single word if you wanted to.
Added tiles that represent long-term goals, like win the Nobel Prize or swim the English Channel. Colin?
The Game of Life?
Yes.
Oh.
Now, this all came as a big surprise to me. When we played the Game of Life, the whole point was just to amass as much money as you possibly could, and then whoever had the most money at the end was the winner. And so they have added to the game now, if you buy it, they're called Life Tiles.
Ah.
So when you do certain things during the game, you get Life Tiles, which you don't flip over until the end, and it tells you... Now, the funny thing is it tells you did something good, like swum the English Channel, and then it just gives you more money. I haven't done that. Merged some categories and added wild card. Colin.
Oh, now I'm not so sure, but I'm going to guess Trivial Pursuit.
Yes.
What?
It used to, like, arts and...
arts and literature?
Arts and literature used to be there was a literature category and an arts category,
okay.
Which they merged, and they merged other categories, and then they added the wild card category, which was not one of the original Trivial Pursuit categories. Triangles and stars were changed to Roman numerals and then back again. These were pieces on the play field.
Mm.
They used to be in the shapes of triangles and stars. They changed them to Roman numerals for a brief period. They changed them back to triangles and stars. Now they're more representative of, like, infantry units. Colin.
Is it Stratego?
No.
It's Risk.
Whoa! Yes. People.
Absolute anarchy has broken out.
I know, seriously. That's why we have these buzzers. Originally published as a pen and paper game called Broadsides. Dana.
Battleship?
Battleship.
Oh.
Gloppy the molasses monster renamed to Gloppy the chocolate monster. Karen.
Kosher land.
No.
Candyland.
Candyland, yes. Yeah, apparently kids don't know what molasses is these days.
Yeah.
Like the metaphor of molasses so. Just doesn't really register as much as it had. What's molasses? So they just call him Gloppy the chocolate monster. They also demoted, you know, some of the queens to princesses for some reason in the later versions of Candyland. Added Brain Freeze, a piece in the shape of an ice cream cone. Dana.
Is it cranium?
It's not cranium. No. Brain Freeze being a type of malady you may suffer from. Colin.
Operation.
Operation. Yeah. The only new piece added to Operation, which was voted on by players, is Brain Freeze. So now there's an ice cream cone in Cavity Sam's brain.
In his head. That's good.
Yeah.
When did
this
happen? Wow, I didn't know there were new pieces.
You start to learn about this because we only played these games as kids, and now they changed them all up and stuff.
Yeah.
So what are they doing?
And his name is Cavity Sam.
His name is Cavity Sam.
I didn't know he had an actual name.
Snakes replaced with something less deadly. Karen.
Shoots.
Yeah,
snakes and ladders.
Snakes and ladders became shoots and ladders. Finally, dark purple changed to brown. Karen.
Monopoly.
Yes!
Oh,
this is what inspired this quiz.
Baltic and Mediterranean Avenue,
right? Did not know that. So if you go and buy Monopoly now, the dark purple spaces right after they're actually changed them to brown.
Oh, I totally associate those with purple.
With dark purple.
Yeah.
I saw that and I was like, no. I looked it up.
I can see how there may be confusions with the dark blue is a Park Place. And
the light purples
Boardwalk.
And dark blues. Yeah, there's too many blue-purpley colors, and there was no brown. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes. Well, good job, everybody's brains, on that quiz. I had one other question that I wanted to ask. Little brain teaser question to see how well you know the game Monopoly. True or false? Because the game mechanics of Monopoly are in the public domain, anyone can make a Monopoly-style game just as long as they do not use the trademarked suffix Opoly. True or false? Colin,
true.
False. Parker Brothers does own the copyright to the names of the Monopoly spaces, and the game mechanics are indeed in the public domain, but the Opoly suffix is also considered to be in the public domain, which is why you see all of those whatever Opoly games.
Yeah.
That, you can, in fact, you can actually do that.
I can make my own
Karenopoly.
Oh, there are. And, you know, I mean, we're close to the Cal campus here, and you can go buy Calopoly, you know, at the student store, and a lot of universities have that.
Yeah. There was the court ruling basically decided that you can do whatever Opoly,
right,
it does not infringe on the Monopoly trademark.
It's funny that you said that. I went against my impulse on that because I did a lot of researching into Monopoly getting ready for the show today. And, you know, a lot of things, now that I'm connecting the dots in my mind, a lot of things, sort of the history of Monopoly came out when the guy who tried to sell the game called Anti-Monopoly basically had to fight a lawsuit. And so a lot of sort of the secrets of the history of Monopoly really only came out as part of this court case. And the guy won, basically.
Yeah.
So I should have known from the fact that he won that maybe that's what you were getting at.
It's actually the same thing in with video games, not to get too off track, but a lot of the history we know about video games, like early electronic games, it only really came to light and became widely disseminated because of court cases fighting over who had the rights to create video game machines and whether certain patents held up. But you're right, it was the same with Monopoly, and I'm sure you've got a lot of that research ready.
Well, I mean, I think we've got a good intro here between talking about court cases of rights and also games changing over time. So, you know, sort of the official line, and certainly what I remember learning, is there's a guy, Charles Darrow, who is really credited as, you know, the father of Monopoly. And Parker Brothers, who publishes the game today, really has a lot invested in maintaining this story as well. And to be fair to him, he did do a lot to advance the game, you know, but he's sort of like a Thomas Edison type figure in the sense that he improved a lot of things, didn't necessarily invent what he is credited with. The proper inventor of the game that we know today as Monopoly is Elizabeth Maggie, and she invented it in 1903, and she was a writer and an inventor and just sort of an all-around awesome lady from the sound of it. So she got
Jill
a patent.
Of all trades.
This wasn't even her first patent. So she got a patent for a game called The Landlord's Game. And the game structure, if you could see a photo of it today, you would look at it, oh yeah, that's clearly where Monopoly came. It had properties, the same number of properties. It had railroads. It had a jail. It had the go square. You could roll doubles or pay $50 to get out of jail. It was clearly the game that we now know as Monopoly. Now, so what's funny or ironic about this is that she created this game to make a point about the immorality study of land ownership and rent gouging and monopolies in general. It was not. It wasn't an aspirational game. You weren't. Yay! I got all the money. I got the monopoly. You were the bad guy essentially if you got the monopoly. But it proved to be a very popular game, and she would play it with friends, and it got it produced. Imagine little pockets of people playing this game and then introducing it to friends in their living rooms and that kind of thing. So it's sort of growing in the network, and people would invent their own home versions of it. So this was really an era of, we love this game, but we play it this way in our circle of friends in Philadelphia. House rules. And, yeah. Oh, we play it this way in Chicago. Or, oh, we play it this way in Baltimore.
I always, after getting into fights with people over Monopoly, I now have a rule. My only, the thing that I do when I play Monopoly is we set the board up, and then I say to everybody, I'm like, okay, if anyone has any house rules or
spit it out,
get it out of the way now.
If you don't like auctioning properties, if you put money under free parking, anything you do.
Yes.
Get it. We all have to be on the same page before we start
this
game.
That is so smart.
So, it's so many times I've been playing Monopoly and people will do something crazy and people are just like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you putting the money there? What do you mean?
I don't like the free parking money rule. Like, I hate that rule.
I don't mind it, but I mean, everybody has to be on a, you know, on the same page as far as how, where the money goes and how do you get it. And especially with auctioning, because a lot of people
don't even know that rule. They don't even know that rule.
That's right. Oh, man.
That's right.
I thought you were going to say your house rule was after you set it up, you're like, well, now if I start losing, I could flip the board over.
You guys agree. Like, you agree.
Like, this is my house.
This is my house rule. I win. I always play, if you land on the go square, you get extra money.
Okay, wait. Extra money in addition to the 200 that you ever passed? Now, see, that's, I don't like those rules. I'm a traditionalist, I guess. I'm a grumpy old man. I like playing by, my mantra was always, the rules on the box. When I play with people, I'm like, the rules on the box. So it is, I mean, it is funny in the sense that as much as I love the rigidity of the rules, I mean, the game wouldn't exist, as I say, without evolving. You know, there was a commercially produced version called The Fascinating Game of Finance, which was really, you know, kind of underselling it, I would say, maybe. But it was essentially a Monopoly. I don't want to say knockoff or clone, because people didn't really think that way. It was just this guy had kind of taken a game he liked and modified it and was selling his own version. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, Charles Darrow eventually got a copy of the game in his hands. And he was sort of a tinkerer and inventor and plumber. And you got to remember, this is the Depression. And, you know, he's like scrambling.
Man, back then, everybody's an inventor slash whatever.
You're right. And, you know, it's, oh, I was an engineer for a while. And then I was a plumber. Mm-hmm. And then I was making board games. And yeah, you're right. You kind of had to sort of invent your own way to go in the Depression. So he was a hustler, and somehow his credit, he hustled hard, and he worked
every
hard,
day.
And he
hustled
busted his butt. Right, so he got his hands on a copy of the game and basically thought, I can improve this. And he did. You know, he really is responsible for the look of the game that we know it. I mean, he hand-drew or hand-stenciled the railroad icons, the little utility bulb, the square blocky go letters and the arrow, like all the visual kind of retro, or what we think of now as retro look, really came from him, and he did it himself because it was on the cheap. You know, he didn't have money to invest in this. Mm-hmm. He was turned down by Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers. Mm-hmm. They both turned him down. So he basically struck a deal with a local department store, a Philadelphia store, and it became a hit. They ordered thousands of dollars worth of sets from him. Keep in mind, this is the Depression era. So Parker Brothers basically got wind of that, and now they wanted in. After he got one department store, he did get a couple more after that. So they wanted in. So here's where the intrigue comes in. They, as soon as they smelled that this was a potential hit on their hands, they went to Elizabeth Maggie and paid her, essentially, to transfer all of her patents on the original games to Parker Brothers.
Yep.
And then they helped Charles Darrow apply for a new patent on this game, Monopoly, in his name, because they essentially were in business with him. The game has, you know, that we know it as Monopoly, has more or less been frozen in that ever since then, ever since they applied for their... And it has, you know, needless to say, been a huge, huge, huge hit and basically saved Parker Brothers from the Depression. And I love the game, just as an aside. I think growing up, probably that was the game that my sister and I and my family played the most, because it could just take hours and hours to play.
You know, the thing is, what we remember as Monopoly today, it, other than the color change of, say, like the Mediterranean avenues, whatever, it's still pretty much the same game.
You know,
not counting the Harry Potter version or the 24 version or the Simpsons version.
Right.
The classic Monopoly, as you said, the same artwork, the same railroad, same prices.
Even for the most part, the same pieces, the gameplay pieces.
Yeah.
So I have a few very quick trivia questions for you guys
about
the game. All right. So I am mentioning the pieces here. So the original game, as we know it, the Parker Brothers common version, Charles Darrow, came with 6 play pieces that you could play with. Mm-hmm. Can you name as many of the 6 pieces as you guys can? All right, Karen.
The Scotty Dog?
No.
Oh, of the original.
Of the very original 1935 edition.
The Shoe?
Shoe, correct.
The Wheelbarrow?
Nope, no wheelbarrow. Oh.
So, okay, the thimble?
Thimble, correct. Shoe, thimble.
The car?
No car.
The horse?
No horse.
Okay, so what do we have?
Hat,
what do we have so far? We have a hat,
shoe,
we have a
thimble,
shoe,
hat.
A thimble. Okay.
The battleship?
The battleship, correct.
Oh.
Shoe, thimble, hat, battleship. There's one more that's still in play. It is the iron.
Oh, right.
The iron.
The iron. Yes. And then there's
those
one.
Those are so random.
They are. Yeah. Well, then there's one more, which was a cannon, like a little piece of artillery with giant wheels. So here's why they're so random. I learned this really interesting.
Were some of them things that were already being manufactured
that
and that they had in surplus?
That is absolutely right.
Like
that
a thimble.
That is absolutely right. The original pieces, if you see photos of the vintage pieces, all have tiny little holes in them. There's a hole in the brim of the hat. There's a hole in the loop of the shoe.
Charms.
They were charms.
Got it.
Cheap and readily available. Yep. And so it
my
kinda,
eyes are like so open
it
and
certainly
big. Like,
seems
whoa.
Like when they went to production, they literally just took charms that were readily available, and that's why they have the holes in them, because they were manufactured from the same molds that were made for put charms on the little bracelets.
That's a really weird thing to have a battleship charm.
No. If you had a relative who was in the Navy and they're on a battleship,
I mean,
you have
cannon,
that to remember
a piece
them.
Of artillery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. All right. So very quickly, a couple more here. What is the most landed on spot on the board? Karen.
Illinois Avenue.
It is Illinois Avenue.
Yeah. I remember, didn't we have a conversation about this at some point?
It's not only, this is excluding go to jail.
No. It's number one overall.
No, you really? Know, yeah, because it's 7 spaces
it's
away from jail.
Number one overall. All go is second overall.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't count the sort of turn taking places, the B&O Railroad would be second.
Right.
But no, Illinois is first overall.
So go for random. A monopoly on those properties.
Yeah.
You've got to buy that monopoly.
Buy red.
They do say that the reds and the oranges gross the most money.
Yes. No.
Yeah. By the jail. That's right. Just
kidding. Well, last one here. All right. Speaking of the jail, what is the name of the little guy we see stuck in the jail?
Oh.
What is his name? He has an official name.
I'm going to say it's like jailbird something.
You were so close. It's something,
jailbird.
Yeah. Something the jailbird. Come on.
Jim. Jesse.
Jake.
Jake the jailbird.
Jake the jailbird.
And yes. the officer has a name, too.
He is Officer Malloy.
There you go.
Yes, very stereotypical, good old Irish cop. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what is the name of the Monopoly guy?
Oh, so they changed it. He is now
Mr. Monopoly,
but he used to be
Rich Uncle Pennybags.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
They actually, so the company spent a lot of money on branding experts and marketing experts and focus group. They did all these tests and marketing for him. And they're like, oh, we need a new name for him. Because, you know, Rich Uncle Pennybags might have a pretty bad connotation.
I love that name.
And with all of that money and effort thrown in, they arrived at Mr. Monopoly. Giving me $1 million. Mr. Monopoly. So I threw it out there to our Twitter followers and our Facebook fans. What is their favorite board game? And you know what? Monopoly is by far the most popular answer.
I can believe it. I mean, it's one of those sort of the big three. You got Monopoly, Scrabble,
maybe.
It's
very family-oriented,
Yeah, it is. And everyone has a copy in there.
Okay, well, speaking of games that kind of came out of the Depression or really got their feet in the Depression, that Scrabble was one of those games, too. It was invented by Alfred Butts, and he was... he was an architect before he got laid off in the Depression. And his other job was a painter and a part-time statistician. Like,
again,
he had his...
another polymath here, yeah.
Part-time statistician.
He decided maybe a good way to make some money was to become a game designer, too. So he had his hands in lots of pots.
He was hedging his bets.
Try different things. And he decided there weren't enough word games, so he's going to focus on that. Even though he wasn't into words, he wasn't a writer. That wasn't one of his part-time jobs, was, you know, spelling or being a writer.
He was
or anything.
A smart businessman, basically.
Yeah.
He saw the blue ocean.
He was reading an Edgar Allan Poe story, and one of the characters was talking about the frequency of letters and words. Like E occurs a lot in S, that kind of thing. And
like, as part of solving a mystery, you mean?
Yes. And so he wanted, as a statistician, he was like, let me check this out. And so he looked in the New York Times and the New York Herald Tribune and some other sources to do a survey of how frequently letters popped up in different words. His first word game was a card game. It wasn't the way Scrabble is now, but it was you got dealt a hand of cards and you had to make 9 and 10 letter words out of your hand of cards and you're going back and forth, whatever. It was a card game. And he sold them to his friends and that went okay. He couldn't sell them to Parker Brothers or Milton Bradley.
I love how every success story is, and Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley turned them down.
They said, no thanks. So then he decided he was going to kind of take that game to the next level. So the first game was called Lexico. He decided to add a board and make it more crossword style. And he put scores and like tiles that give you triple word score and put those on the fringes so people can come back. He did a really good job balancing this game out.
Yeah.
So he made this game and he called it Crisscross Words. I imagine him in his living room making these boards
with his
architect skills. He like measured them out with the ruler and got all the little pieces of balsa wood cut out. And he sold the licensing rights to this guy named James Bruneau. And James Bruneau is the one who changed it to Scrabble. And it took them about 5 years before it started catching on. They sold them to people and they would take them to their vacation homes. And a buyer from Macy's was on vacation, as the story goes, and played the game and was like, oh, this game is awesome. I love this game. Why isn't it in our stores? Although he said it in 1952 speak. He probably didn't say this game is awesome.
This game is the bee's knees.
It's the cat's meow.
And then you guys might have gone back a couple decades to it.
No, definitely not. Then he curled a little out of the top hat and did the Charleston.
Stepped into his auto gyro.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my ragtime gal.
Life was so much better. I wish I lived in musical days.
The buyer from Macy's ordered a bunch of Scrabble from James Bruneau, and it basically went viral, but old-timey viral. I don't even know how to think outside the internet anymore. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just, I mean, you have to imagine, like, for all these games, I think, board games, just getting together with, you know, other grown-ups and having a game in your parlor or your living room.
Very grassroots. So I don't think I've mentioned on the show before, but I used to play Scrabble semi-professionally. Like, I was in the official Scrabble club of San Francisco.
In the league,
I never did, like, the big, obviously, I was not good enough to play tournaments and stuff. And we know there are a lot of books, very famous book, Word Freak, and documentaries about professional tournament Scrabble players.
Right.
And that is a really eye-opening kind of, it's a different level.
I mean, yeah. I really do believe, like, at the highest levels of Scrabble, it's a game of code.
It's not a game of
vocabulary by any stretch.
They don't know
and
what the
fact,
words mean.
Many of the best players don't even speak English.
Yep,
I mean,
yep.
It's not only is it like, I mean, we all play those 3 and 4 little Scrabble words sometimes.
Dog.
I don't know what this means. I just know it's legal.
Yeah, it's
but I mean, yeah, it is. It's just a game of pattern recognition. What's the highest possible pattern I can fit here? It's not about language at a certain point.
And I remember I used to stay up every night and I would try to memorize all possible 2-letter and 3-letter combination words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
we had
different
choices.
You have to know them. And at one point it's just becoming like, oh, I know etymology wise, these are legitimate words. Put them together, they might form a real word, but I'm not even sure if that exists.
And then part of it's bluffing, too.
Yeah.
Do you want to challenge me?
the absolute best thing that you can do for yourself as a living room or dining room Scrabble player, you know, if you just play against like your relatives or friends or whatever, is memorize. It's a short list. Memorize the 2-letter words.
Yep.
Because what that does for you is it actually breaks the game open and it gives you a second, way to add words to the board.
Yeah.
Because typical Scrabble players either placing words horizontally or vertically, they're either crossing through a word or they're adding a letter like an S onto the end of a word.
Yeah.
When you memorize, and there's not very many of them, but you memorize all the playable 2-letter words, you can now add it parallel.
That's one of
to a word.
Yeah.
And it gives you, just doing that gives you a brand new move that other people don't have in their arsenal. So, as many of our listeners, our constant listeners know, we are in fact on a trivia team, and the finals, the big Bay Area League finals came up recently. It was a heartbreaker. There were 3 rounds.
We
were in first place at the end of the first round. We were in first place at the end of the second round. We finished at the end of the third round in 9th. All the stuff we knew was in the first 2 rounds. But anyway, they gave us some things to study, and one of the things that they told us to study was know the Bill of Rights. And that was just like, okay, we can do this. We can memorize what, you know, and basically it was just going to be like, you know, we knew there was going to be a question that was going to be, you know, what amendment which, to the, you know, Constitution.
And it's never one of the obvious ones. Yeah,
exactly.
It's not First it's Amendment, it's not Fifth Amendment. Right.
Right. And so I started thinking to myself, okay, there's got to be a mnemonic piece of poetry somewhere on the internet that helps you memorize the Bill of Rights. And all I found were people on the internet asking for a mnemonic piece of poetry, you know? And so I'm like,
there's
okay,
there's gotta be
right.
a better way.
Yes, and that I've gotta be able to write some bit of doggerel that will help us to memorize the Bill of Rights. So I took it upon myself to compose a mnemonic poem.
This is a public service announcement.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll print this on the website for this episode as well. But here is a way that you can memorize. Basically, this assumes familiarity with what the Bill of Rights is, basically what the amendments say.
Right.
This is helping us get to the order.
It's a prompt.
When people ask you what amendment says this. So this is what I wrote. This was rough. I did it pretty quickly, but I think it works. Speech and such are the first rights. Two arms, let's fight. Three's a crowd, you can't stay here. Four, don't look through my things, dear. Five, because I plead the fifth. This is complemented with six, which says my day in court will be a speedy public sort. Lucky seven means a jury. Eight is no big deal, don't worry. We have nine lives and way more rights. People and states have equal might. So let me just run down really quickly.
Yes, yeah. Bravo.
Thank you.
Maestro.
So let me just run down really quickly. Speech and such are the first rights. The First Amendment is the freedom of speech,
right.
but also religion, of the press,
right,
of
right.
Petition, and
freedom of self-expression.
Assembly,
yes,
all that kind
right,
of stuff.
Right.
Two arms. So two, of course, Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. Three's a crowd, you can't stay here. Third is about they can't quarter soldiers in your homes. The government can't show up and be like, hey, this soldier lives in your house now. Three's a crowd, don't stay here. Four, don't look through my things, dear. That is, of course, a
search and seizure.
Right. Five, because I plead the fifth. This is you cannot incriminate yourself at trial. This is also other things like, you know, double jeopardy and other kind of stuff. The Sixth Amendment is the right to a public speedy trial, and also in a criminal trial to a trial by jury.
Right.
The Seventh Amendment is just about if you have a civil trial, you also can have a trial by jury.
And these are certainly the ones where it gets murky.
In a trivia
challenge.
Right. These are the broad strokes. Eight is no big deal. Don't worry. That turned out to be the trivia question that we got asked. What is the amendment that concerns excessive bail or cruel and unusual punishment?
Yep.
That is the Eighth Amendment. No big deal. Don't worry. Your bail won't be excessive. Don't worry. We're not going to put you in the stockades. We have nine lives and way more rights. The Ninth and Tenth are the weird ones. So the Ninth Amendment is, just because we said you had these rights in the Constitution doesn't mean you don't have other rights.
That's so meta.
It's just like,
this
look.
This is including but not limited to.
Yeah. And it was because they realized that, look, we're fallible. You know what I mean? Like, we wrote this Constitution. Just because we didn't put it in here doesn't mean you don't have that right.
They rightly sensed that we would become a nation of lawyers.
Exactly. And finally, the Tenth Amendment, people and states have equal might. Any right that is not given to the federal government is reserved to the states or to the people. That gives you the basics on how to memorize the Bill of Rights.
That's a
good
one.
Most people know 1, 2, and 5, and yeah.
Right.
What are the other ones?
Comes up a lot.
Good job. All right, we're going to have this one on the site in our mnemonic archive, along with all the other mnemonics we featured on the show, so hopefully this will be helpful one day. Yeah. One day.
Just so you know your rights.
Yeah.
Not just for trivia.
Right, exactly.
Of course, this being a trivia podcast, we cannot not talk about, of course, Trivial Pursuit, the game that inspired our very own Pop Quiz Hot Shot segment, though different today. And I don't know if people know this, but I certainly didn't. Trivial Pursuit is Canadian.
Oh, yeah.
What?
I did know that.
It's Canadian.
I did know they were Canadian inventors.
Why is that shocking? What are you trying to say about Canadians?
It's just, if I were Canadian, I would tell everybody this. I'd be so proud.
The national
we
game?
Made Trivial Pursuit. Who cares about hockey
right.
or beer?
Mike Myers, Trivial Pursuit,
yeah.
Hockey.
Pamela Anderson.
Probably other things.
Wayne Gretzky, Steve Nash, Trivial Pursuit. See, I know sports too. If someone told me that Trivial Pursuit was an overnight success, I would totally believe them. You know, right? Like, how can Trivial Pursuit not be an overnight success? Obviously, we're a little bit biased because we're trivia nuts, but like the idea, you're like, of course, people will love this. And of course, that is not the way it happened. And it was a really long and bumpy ride for inventors, Canadian inventors, Chris Haney and Scott Abbott. And they started off in the early 80s and hoping that this would be very successful, and it took them a long time. They got a few friends to help them out in terms of investment, and they're like, okay, well, we have the idea. They have the whole wheel. They're also trivia nuts, too. They actually were reporters and journalists for, you know, Canadian newspapers in Montreal. But the thing is, now they have a little bit of investment. They have the whole kind of idea of the game. However, no one predicted one big problem about Trivial Pursuit and why it will take a lot of money to make.
Do you guys
what it might be?
I was just gonna guess, like, just something around the volume of questions they would have to produce. Yes.
Exactly. Well, not even that, because I mean, they're trivia nuts, they can find out a lot of the questions and stuff. It's the cards. Imagine how many questions there are and how many cards they would have to print.
It's true. The game would be very expensive.
Double print on both sides with full color.
Right.
It's just, you know, these boxes of cards. And no one really, back in the day, thought about it. Like, oh, oops, yeah, there's this big production cost. And the funny thing is, the original Trivial Pursuit game was one of costliest games to produce.
That makes sense.
Because it's all just printing. It's not just a board and some plastic pieces. Right. It's a board and some plastic pieces and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of
everything,
cards. It's
everything other games have, plus way more.
And those are very, I mean, I remember the original set. Like, those two decks of cards are heavyweight. Those are beefy. Yeah.
And, you know, after finally getting the first batch of games produced, Haney and Abbott, they're ready for their big time debut. You know, they had plans, they had their eyes set on the big toy fairs in Canada, especially the toy fair in New York, for debuting this awesome Trivial Pursuit game.
What year is this? When is this?
This was 1982. What else was going on with games back in 1982? Donkey Kong and the whole arcade game sweep. And of course, all the toy fairs and the conventions were just, you know, basically they had video game fever. And, like, they look at Trivial Pursuit and be like, who wants to sit around and move pieces and
all
read
these
questions
cards.
Out of cards? Exactly.
Right.
But Trivial Pursuit did prevail through word of mouth, like previous board games we talked about. And finally, people took notice, and mostly because of the game itself. It's not a kiddie game.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference when you look at board games. And a lot of our family oriented. Scrabble can be both a kid game and an adult game, but really Trivial Pursuit was like, this is for
adults. I remember, it must have been the mid-80s, I guess, by the time it finally hit markets then. But I remember when it came out, and just even as a kid thinking, this looks like a grown-up game. Because the design, there weren't big flashy cartoon bubbles and, you know.
And that was very
molasses
smart of them.
Monster.
It looked very elegant. It had to look like something, like a handsome set of encyclopedias that you would place into your cabinet in your living room.
They had a pretty low budget creating the look of the game. That's why it's kind of sparse and very serious, which is a happy coincidence.
Hey, pro tip, inventors, minimal is cheap.
Exactly. And their marketing was pretty genius. Back in the day when they debuted the game, they sent every celebrity mentioned in the game a copy of the game.
That's clever.
God.
That's smart.
That is really such good marketing.
That's good.
On their magazine print ads, they would have example cards and example questions. Like in their ads, here's a challenge.
The first one's free. Yeah.
And of course, Trivial Pursuit spawned. Oh God, there's so many different variations of Trivial Pursuit. And, you know, like we said,
Star Wars Trivial Pursuit, Simpsons Trivial Pursuit, Twilight,
Disney, which my fiance Regina constantly asks me, "Do you want to play Disney Trivial Pursuit with me?" I'm like, "What?" So I can just sit there and just feel horrible for 3 hours.
Here, I actually brought from the comforts of my own home an example Trivial Pursuit card from the Star Wars edition.
My goodness.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to link this back to one of our previous episodes. We talked about, in our all quiz, I believe, we talked about the Parsec and Han Solo and the Kessel Run. And you guys called it. We got a lot of emails regarding whether or not Han Solo correctly or incorrectly talked about the Parsec. But here I have the Star Wars Trivial Pursuit card. And let's see how well everybody, but mostly Colin, does on this.
You never know.
Here we go. I'm not even going to pick up my buzzer.
Oh.
All right. I have no idea what these categories are, so here we go. Which leg does Han Solo strap his blaster to?
50-50. I'm going to say his left leg.
It,
right.
I believe it's his right leg.
I think he's right-handed.
It is on his right leg.
50-50, still got it wrong.
All right. What type of ship discovered the Falcon when it arrived in the Alderaan system?
What type of ship? Imperial cruiser? I'm not sure what they're looking for, yeah.
Incorrect. It is a TIE fighter.
Oh, okay. Right. It was like a...
That's all right. That's how it feels.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really dumb.
Bonus point. What does TIE stand for?
That is twin ion engine.
Correct.
Oh.
Here's back to the card. What was the gift Luke Skywalker gave to Jabba the Hutt?
These two droids.
Yes!
Oh, his sister.
Incorrect.
R2-D2 and C-3PO. Yes. These fine droids. Okay. How many moons circle Yavin according to the Death Star's orbital schematic? Come on, Colin.
Is it three?
Incorrect. Four.
Four.
I can hear our fans so like close. Right now being like, "Oh my god!"
Yavin four.
What did R2-D2 falsely claim was merely old data?
I don't even know if that was the hologram of Princess Leia.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay. What did John Molo design for Star Wars to earn a mention in the credits?
It's the lightsaber.
That's a good guess, actually.
Delicious B. Crumb?
It is costumes.
Wait,
you get a special mention specific, and not like an actual credit? That seems like a
weird anticlimactic trivia answer.
That's not a thank you. That's an actual job. Yeah.
He received mention for.
We just want to thank you for all this. Okay.
We also paid
this
me
is in
for
addition to
I'm
the paycheck.
I'm still getting paid, though, right?
It's a lot of cool board game talk, and came across this, and I thought it was a really lovely note, and I want to end our board game talk by sharing a quote. And keep in mind, this is back in the early 80s and electronic games were on the rise, right? And board game people were kind of freaking out, and it was just a weird time for that whole industry. Richard Selchow, then president of Selchow and Ryder Company, makers of Scrabble and Parcheesi, said in a magazine, and this is his quote, "One hears a lot of debate in the industry about future of games. Are electronics the wave of the future? Will board games survive? We feel these discussions are somewhat irrelevant. There should be no dispute about whether the future of games lies in microcomputers or small wooden game pieces. There is ample room for both if the game involved are fun to play."
I like that attitude. Very, very cute. There's always room for quality.
Well, again, I mean, board games can still do things the computers cannot. There really is something to the honor system imposed by board games versus video games.
That's a really good point.
When you play, I mean this in both ways, because when you play a video game, the video game always keeps track and it tells you, you can't do that, and it gives you the exact right amount of money, especially with kids, you know, like Candyland. Candyland is a game of total random chance, right? When you shuffle the cards and have the card deck in front of you, a winner has been predetermined, and it is not about playing the game, it is about learning how to wait and take your turn and follow instructions and be honest, because a game is just a set of rules. And this comes back to me and like the house rules of Monopoly. It's like the entire point of this game is that we all agree to submit ourselves to a set of rules.
Yeah.
We all have to have these rules. And that's like what is fun is here's the set of rules. Work within that set of rules to have the good outcome. And so that's what's interesting about the honor system of board games is that you have to all kind of mutually enforce that set where video games, it takes over for you. In video games, Scrabble, sometimes they don't let you play bogus words.
Yes.
But
that's part of the game. Bluffing is part of the game.
I absolutely agree. So either way, whether you're a bluffer or whether, you know, whether bluffing is part of the game or not, which video games, you know, have trouble letting you do it, or whether it's all about like being on the honor system, like not giving up that control and having to have that human control is what makes it so appealing.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys listeners for listening, and hope this inspires you to get out that board game and play something with your friends or families and whatnot. And you can find us on Zune Marketplace, on iTunes, on our website, which is goodjobbrain.com. Join us on Facebook and Twitter. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.
Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I would like to be? I can fly higher than an eagle, 'cause you are the wind beneath my wings.